Hello and welcome to episode 5 of season 2 of The Last Team on Turf. Let's get started. I'm Eric Warista.
This is Noam Shore.
And you're listening to The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast. Well, Noam, it's been a couple weeks since our last podcast. The Revs undefeated in 4, at 3 ties, and then a big win this weekend over a Miami team that was more mess than messy.
That's right, Eric. This weekend was a big game. I think there was an extra buzz in the stadium, as probably most people know by now. Lionel Messi has signed with MLS and is going to be playing with Inter Miami CF. It's quite a long name for a club name. And it was exciting. It was exciting, people going in knowing that all of a sudden the league has a relevance that, not that we needed it, but it's a big deal.
Maybe we should start here. So 36,325 in attendance last Saturday at Gillette Stadium.
Right.
Not among that number, Lionel Messi. So how many fans do you think thought they were coming to see Messi and just hadn't paid close enough attention to know that he wouldn't be there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was trying to think more optimistically that maybe thought that people maybe thought that he would make an appearance, you know, off the plane, signing with MLS, could wave to the crowd. That would be pretty exciting.
Right.
But no, there was no Messi, and Miami was as bad as their record shows that they are.
Right. Yeah, it really came across. I was watching this one on TV, and there was nothing there for Miami. And I thought maybe they'd come out with a little extra fire because they're going to lose that one roster spot once Messi comes in. The other, you know, 25 guys are basically, they're taking one of the seats away in the game of musical chairs. But
right. Or even just playing for pride, like Messi's coming. You want to show that he's joining a team that has some fire, has some spark.
Right. You deserve to be there. Exactly. Yeah.
That's a big deal if you're a player there. And I feel bad for one of the Miami players appeared to have really hurt his knee seriously on that Gillette turf. That's the second time I've seen somebody lose a knee this season. Barrero being the other person, and from the Revolution. And that's just not good to see. It's just really sad when a player goes down like that, and that might have impacted. That was in the first half. That could have impacted Miami too.
Right, non-contact, seemingly turf related injury.
Right.
But talk a little bit about the buzz in the stands around Messi joining the league.
Yeah, and just this is the buzz in the stands too from a large crowd. Over 35,000 people. There's fans in the second level in the corners, not just in the Putnam section above the sideline, and it actually felt like a soccer stadium, like a real bona fide soccer game that meant something with such a big crowd. And statistically, Eric, I think we can actually prove this. I just didn't have the time to do the analysis, but I think every time the Revolution have a big game, meaning not necessarily a big game of importance, but a game when there's a big crowd, like close to 35,000 people or 30,000, which happens now sometimes, I don't think they've ever won a game with that many people there. Like, I can even go back to 2014, where they had a big crowd for the playoff game. Yes, they won the series against the New York Red Bulls, but it was a tie game at the game 2 at Gillette Stadium.
Right.
They always seem to turn out a stinker, and what was kind of funny is that this time it was the opposite. It would almost lacked drama because it was a 3-1, basically a blowout.
Right. No, that's your memory is very consistent with mine, that whenever that crowd ticks up above 25 or 30,000, the Revs seem to play very tight. They don't score. They often lose. And I'd love to see the dot plot on that to see how they have performed historically. Have there been any other big wins in front of big crowds at Gillette?
Right.
None jump out for me.
Yeah. So perhaps Miami, feeling the pressure of Messi, played below their level, and the Revs rose to the occasion, sending a message to Messi that Carlos Heel is on the revolution, had two assists and a goal, and put the game away pretty early. And it was a kind of a clunker for the last 20 minutes. Once the Revs were really up, they took the foot off the gas, and there was some consternation by the coaches about that. But they played a good game otherwise.
And I wonder how much of the motivation, too, on the Rev side is, and for the rest of the league, you know, if we can bury this Miami team at the bottom of the standings before Messi gets there, then you could potentially make it somewhat challenging for them to make the playoffs this year. Now, it's MLS, just about everybody makes the playoffs. If you look, you know, in the Eastern Conference, 9 of the 15 teams will make the playoffs. Miami's in 15th place. They're 7 points down, but there are, we guess, because we don't know, but we guess that Miami will have 4 more games before Messi gets here.
Mm.
So if they lose those...
That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe Arena's really putting the fire in the players, saying, hey, we don't want to face Messi in the playoffs. Let's take care of business today.
And so they're only 7 points back of the last playoff spot right now, but depending on how things go the next few weeks, if these other teams are thinking about it the same way, that we better beat Miami now, because if they sneak in as the 9 seed, it will be tough. There'll be a tough out with Messi and, you know, 10 peanut vendors out there. I think they'd have a pretty good chance.
That is true. That is true. Well, we were left with the stadium buzz, happily chanting, "Where is Messi?" or "You're not Messi," and that helped the Revs overcome. Actually, I should point out, was a difficult start. Some early giveaways to start the game that led to a couple breakaway type of opportunities for Miami. It was a little bit rough at the beginning, but the Revs stepped up eventually.
So I was listening to this game or watching the game with the local audio, so Charlie Davies and Brad Feldman, which was
right.
Felt really good, just from the standpoint of I haven't listened to them do a game since last season. Some of that was my technical difficulties trying to figure out how to change the audio on Apple TV. But once I figured it out, or once someone told me, it's actually very easy. And it was just very refreshing to hear local announcers who know the team, who are close to the team and the players from a news standpoint, from a how they want to play and philosophy of playing standpoint. So that was much better. And actually, I got kind of both perspectives, because the first half I watched live and I had the local announcers. And then on the replay, I don't think the local announcers are available, so I had the national broadcast, which was fine, but it wasn't quite as good.
Yeah, so what were the differences for you in listening to both for the same game?
For me, it was the depth of knowledge about where the team and the players are in their journey through the season. When a player like Gustavo Bou, who's missed a lot of time with injury this year, but is a designated player, either makes a play or doesn't make a play, on the national broadcast, there was almost no context for it. It was just, this guy is supposed to be this type of player, and he is or he isn't. Whereas in the local broadcast, I felt like they had a lot more context around, you know, he barely played last week. He's barely played at all in the first 3 months of the season. And this is really his first extended appearance. And you can see the chemistry that he has with some of the players like Carlos Heel, and chemistry hopefully he's developing with someone like a Bobby Wood. So you just had a lot more context and color, where the national broadcast, yeah, you know, it was more, okay, he's this type of player, he's a designated player, why isn't he scoring every time he touches the ball, kind of thing.
More on the national broadcast, more sound bites versus more nuanced perspectives from the longtime broadcasters. So the Chicago game, I listened to Brad Feldman and Charlie Davies, and I liked hearing their commentary as well. Unfortunately, the audio mix was not that great, and I've heard that a couple times when I've listened in on this one, where it's either too loud or too soft, and it kind of feels detached from the game, like just the crowd noise doesn't seem to be mixed in as well, but maybe it was just that game, and there were some technical issues as they were fading a couple times. But one thing I really liked was that the Revolution started that game just really abysmal. They were down 2-0 and just playing terribly, turnovers, own goals. And Charlie Davies was just rightly, just really calling out the team. And I just appreciate that kind of honesty and commentary from broadcasters who should be telling you something about the team and what they could be doing and how they could be better. And that just teed up a moment later when Charlie Davies was complaining again. Noel Buck just hits a stunner of a goal. If you haven't seen the game, anyone who's listening, watch the highlights, the Chicago Fire versus Revolution. It's worth watching them just for Noel Buck's goal, which was just this thunder of a strike out well outside the penalty box. And what was unique is that this one, often they like the ball will rise and then dip. This ball was on a straight line trajectory, maybe 5, at most 6 feet off the ground from distance. Mm. It was really just an amazing strike.
It certainly was, and it's definitely worth watching again. I think you touched on something really interesting there, which is that Charlie Davies is willing to criticize players. One of the pet peeves with announcers who are former players or former coaches is that a lot of them are unwilling to criticize players. They share that bond of having been in that locker room, and they don't want to get on the bad side of the team. And I think it's refreshing that Davies is willing to tell you what he thinks and when people make mistakes. He's also quick with praise, so it's definitely two-sided.
Right.
But I think as a fan, it's very helpful and illustrative because you actually learn a little more of the nuance of the game. And I get it, it's a hard job. I know fans have high expectations, but when you have an announcer who's willing to call out someone who's not making the right play or consistently maybe not making the right play, it is validating in a lot of ways for the fans' point of view, but it's also instructive.
Exactly, it's educational. I learned something from that too, because you have a former U.S. national team star who's able to explain the nuances and strategies that players in different positions can take to do well in those roles. So it definitely helps me understand the game better too. So speaking of national broadcasts, the next couple games actually feature Taylor Twellman, former Rev star and soccer commentator now. And I think he does a really good job as a commentator, and I really enjoyed hearing his commentary during the Atlanta game and then NYFC. Also, I think brings good insights, and as you're pointing out, Eric, I think also brings that perspective of having been there as a player, is a little bit more insightful and a little bit more direct in his commentary about what's going on the pitch.
He's one of these guys who has something that's become increasingly rare in sports broadcasting, in that he is very insightful and knowledgeable about what's happening on the field, but is able to poke fun at himself, poke fun at the game. Takes it very seriously, but yet doesn't take every single comment so seriously that it takes all the fun out of the game. He seems like he's having fun.
Right.
As a fan watching, yeah, you're generally having fun too.
He certainly does, and that was an exciting game to be calling as well, the Atlanta game. It was a back-and-forth affair. The Revs were up 2-0 at one point, and they really started to crumble, and all of a sudden Atlanta ties it. They go ahead 3-2, and they don't roll over, though, and end up tying the game right at the end, which was very dramatic and perhaps a season-saving goal from Carlos Heel from Farrell on a cross to tie the game right at the 92nd minute, I think, right, or even later in the match, actually. So one thing that I thought was cool in that game from a commentary perspective was that the game was pretty exciting. And at times the commentators, both Twellman and I'm forgetting the name, unfortunately, of the lead play-by-play, there were periods of time during the game where they just didn't say anything. and it's Atlanta Stadium. It gets loud there. There was a big crowd. Even on a Wednesday night, there was something like 35,000 people. And the game, they just let the game play, and you could hear the crowd noise. And I just really appreciated that quiet, and you could just focus on the game, and then they would chime in. They would start to bring back the commentary when they had something to say. But otherwise, it was all about the game. I feel like I don't see enough of that in really most sports, but that's good to see.
Yeah, absolutely. You get to get more of a feeling like you're actually there, and the game lets the game speak for itself a little bit more. Say one thing that tends to speak for itself when you're watching it on TV, especially, is the pitch dimensions at Yankee Stadium, which just jump off the screen as being narrower than regulation. And it just looks terrible. The playing surface seems even worse than Gillette in a lot of ways, even though it's grass. The number of times the ball is lost when they're playing on the infield dirt that's been covered with sod that it doesn't even seem lined up with, each piece doesn't seem lined up with the other. I mean, it's a turnover and or an injury just waiting to happen.
Right. It does look sketchy out there. And sometimes when the ball goes out of bounds, it actually travels a long way because of the dimensions of the baseball stadium and the soccer field. There are these huge end lines. Like when they pivoted to a VAR replay with the referee needing to look at a TV, like it's like he's out in a pasture somewhere and you can't even see the sidelines. I have to say, Yankee Stadium for soccer is the one thing that makes Gillette look like an elite level stadium for soccer.
Right.
It's that bad. And it goes beyond the dimensions of the stadium and the soccer field, which just unfortunately doesn't fit there. Even the camera angles seem odd. Like the camera angle for TV, it seems lower than in most stadiums. And in theory, I would like that. It seems like you would have a closer perspective, like having a better seat. But on TV, it felt like you're almost watching a college game, you know, where there isn't a large stands on the side to put a TV camera. So it's lower. It just comes across as an amateur situation.
Yeah, it's a little bit like some of those Caribbean stadiums that have a track and field track around the stadium, and yeah. So the crowd is back from the field another, you know, 30 or 40 yards. And when
Europe also has some of those for some reason. West Ham, I think, actually plays in an Olympic stadium now, right? In London, same thing.
Oh, it could be. Yeah, it's been a while since I've watched a West Ham game, at least. I think I've more recently seen one on Ted Lasso than an actual West Ham game.
Yeah, so the pitch was difficult to watch, and in fact, I just, you know, Yankee Stadium is a legendary stadium, right, for baseball. But after you watch soccer there, it just makes it look bad for any sport.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. It's the new Yankee Stadium, right? So it's that stadium's only about 10 years old, maybe 15 years old now. But I don't know that it has the same character that the old stadium had. And it's really designed for baseball. It's not a multi-use stadium. Yeah. They have other events there. They've had college football bowl games there. They've had concerts there. Soccer, obviously, yeah. But it's every year it becomes increasingly weird that the Revs play where they play and New York City plays where they play, and because the quality of stadia and crowds and atmosphere just keeps going up. I mean, look at St. Louis. It's a perfect example.
Well, in the spirit of our podcast name, NYFC is closer to getting their own stadium than the Revolution are.
Right.
Designs are out. I'm not sure if ground has been broken yet, but they're going to build right next to the Mets stadium, apparently. And the stadium looks awesome. Crickets for the Revolution at this point.
Yeah, absolutely nothing happening on the stadium front that we know about. And it's I was thinking more about what we talked about last week about the World Cup and this idea of a permanent temporary grass field or a temporary permanent grass field going in. And it's just so ridiculous that they would put the time in to put this field down and then rip it up. And where are the Revs going to play in 2026? Because if they're building that field from scratch, they're going to want to plant it in March or April and grow it in. So the Revs won't be able to play there. The MLS season starts in February. They're not going to be able to play there leading up to the World Cup. And then if they're going to rip it out and put turf down for the Patriots season, they're not going to be able to play there after the World Cup for some time. So
yeah, that's a good point. I'm getting a little stressed out about that now that you bring it up. I just refuse to think about it at this year, at this day. But
yeah, no sense worrying about 2026. By then, Messi will be in and then probably out of the league by then. But it is a question where you're going through all the trouble to do this thing. Maybe just put a grass field in and live with it. Yeah. The Patriots might not mind it either. The players anyway might prefer that.
Right, that is true. So just a couple other quick observations from the last few games. One, Petrovic, the goalie, consistently keeps the Revolution in games with just astounding save after astounding save, including a PK save recently. We just have to call out, I think his play is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And Carlos Heel, too, I think I brought up in the last podcast episode how it was kind of comical to see the referees giving warnings to players after he gets fouled so much that the next one's going to be a yellow card. And sure enough, it happened again in the New York City game. I wrote down here that the warnings were given out and it was only the 8th minute of the game. Of course, small field, I guess people are even closer to heel in a field like that. But it's almost like you could put some wages on this, on Carlos Heel here. How soon does the yellow warning come out?
Right. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And there was a foul in the Miami game that summed it up where he wasn't in a dangerous spot on the field. He was dribbling around in his own half of the field. And the Miami player just reached out, grabbed the jersey and brought him down. And the ref called a foul. To me, it should have been a yellow. I mean, it was totally a senseless foul. An obvious foul, and not one that really had to be embellished at all. He just flat out grabbed his jersey and said, "I'm not chasing this guy anymore."
Yeah, I think the reason why it wasn't a yellow, because it was an obvious yellow card foul, was just, it was almost like a schoolyard prank. You know, it's like, oh, this good kid has the ball, you're just going to grab his shirt.
Right.
Like, it was almost slow motion. Of course, Heel went down. Of course, he was dragged down, but it wasn't violent like sometimes other fouls are, unfortunately, when he does get tackled. But it was funny. He was laughing.
Yeah.
it was almost comical.
True. So Heel's fourth in assist in the league this year. He's third in key passes. And not to be overlooked, he's also let me pull it up here. He is also 1, 2, 3. I think he's fourth or fifth in goals scored. So another great season from him. And Petrovic in goal. Yeah, absolutely. Without him, there's no way they'd be where they are in the standings this year.
Right. So the big news this week was Messi, or last week. But really, you can see fantastic soccer with Carlos Heel. I'll take him any day. It's worth going to a Revs game if you haven't been to one this season. He's at the top of his game again.
Absolutely. And maybe we could end there, but maybe just real quickly, what are your thoughts, expectations for what Messi's time in MLS will be like?
Prediction for Messi. Well, in terms of stature and importance, I have to go back to Pele, right? Like, Pele brought the game to the United States. It wasn't even here. Now the game is established and you're getting one of the world's, like the biggest star on the world stage right now, coming off of an incredible World Cup win. And he's playing pretty well. Maybe not as, you know, he's not at his prime, but playing great soccer. You know, Argentina won the World Cup because of Messi.
Right.
And others. So I think he's going to have a big impact, and the excitement is going to be amazing. Like, would Gillette realistically even come close to selling out? I think it could if Messi were to play here.
Interesting. What about on the field?
I think he's going to be great.
Yeah.
I think he's going to be
great. I think so too. I don't know how good that team will be this year, but I wouldn't bet against them next year. Thank you so much for listening.
And we'll talk again in a few weeks, Eric.
thank you for listening to The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast with Eric Warriston and Noam Shore. We hope you enjoyed the show and can't wait to hear from you. The show was hosted, produced, and edited by Eric Warriston and Noam Shore, and all opinions expressed are their own. Incidental music written, arranged, and performed by Eric Warriston. Rev's crowd clips appear courtesy of the New England Revolution. Last Team on Turf is a production of Row 12 Media.